Okay, today is day two of the oral history. Again, I'm Hilary Domisch, and with me is Jacqueline Boytum, and Dr. Hegedus was just about to give a brief summary of what we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, so what I said yesterday is as follows. I've grown up in difficult times in the communist Hungary of the 1950s. Had wonderful and supporting parents and family. Had a strong and humanities-oriented high school education in Szolnok. Had an excellent university education in Budapest, very hard work. Looking back, it gave me a very strong background. My first job in Hungary in process research, enjoyed it very much. Then I was very fortunate to get to Germany and found a great job at the car company, which was at that time called Daimler-Benz, not there, called Mercedes-Benz. And I was also even more fortunate to get admitted at Berkeley and obtained a PhD in chemical engineering in 1972 in specializing in reaction engineering. So I believe we are at that point.
We are.
Or are we still talking a little bit about Berkeley? Or
well, I wanted to ask really quickly if there was anything else that you wanted to talk about at Berkeley. You mentioned that you had 7 publications that you got your research advisor really excited and really interested in what you were doing, and it sounded
like research.
And vice
versa.
I'm sorry.
And also vice versa.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. We had great back and forth. Yes. Outstanding. But I wanted to, perhaps I could say about Berkeley, is that you come out of there, you truly feel that you are at the leading edge of what you are doing. And you actually discover that not only do you feel so, but you actually are at the leading edge of what you are doing. So it gives you tremendous confidence. And you feel like you're able to tackle anything. And it was just a totally wonderful experience. It is just a great place.
That's wonderful. Before we leave Berkeley, one of the things that Jacqueline and I were interested in, around the time period that you're in Berkeley doing all this research, getting kind of really settled in America, a lot of things are going on in Los Angeles related to the Motor Vehicle Pollution Control Board. Mm-hmm. People are talking mm-hmm. a lot about pollution. Mm-hmm. People are talking a lot about a lot of things at this time, protests about various things. Mm-hmm. But we were very curious about whether any of the talk about emissions and automobile exhaust and pollution, any of that conversation that was taking place in LA was making its way to you up in Berkeley?
A great question. In fact, we had seminars, our research group, Jim Peters, and we could select papers from the literature and discuss with other students in the group. And amazingly, I did select some papers written by Shalev and Gandhi at Ford. Mm. Ren Gandhi and Mordecai Shalev. It was about NOx emission control. And I'm sure it had some influence on my eventual selection of General Motors as my next station in life. Yes, there was a discussion about that. Yeah. It was not a very strong thread yet at that time, but yes.
So how did you make the transition to General Motors and to Michigan from Berkeley? How did that come about?
Well, firstly, you look for jobs, and that was a very difficult time in the U.S. for chemical engineering graduates, all in general. 1972, the spring of 1972, was not a boom year in economy, so there were not so many jobs. But I was very lucky. I worked in Catholicism, and Catholicism, as you know, relates both to energy and also to the environment. So I had 4 excellent offers, and it was very difficult to decide.
Can I ask where the other offers were?
Yes, DuPont, Engelhard, Union Carbide, and General Motors. These were all, you know, top-notch companies. These were all, you know, outstanding opportunities. It was very difficult to decide. But, you know, General Motors sent their then-time research vice president to Berkeley to recruit. Wow. I was very impressed. They said that, you know, they have to put catalysts on millions and millions of cars. And I thought, voila, this will be the largest application of catalysts on Earth. And being a reactor person, you know, the chemical reactor person, I said, they want to manufacture millions of chemical reactors. Wow, this has never been done before. So I got very excited about the idea.
Did you apply to or look to go back to Chevron, where you had worked for those couple of months?
Yes, I did, and we had a discussion, but somehow the opening they would have had and what I was doing did not match very well at that time. Later on, I, of course, had an opportunity to go back to Chevron, etc., but then I elected, you know, to stay there. Mm-hmm. But it's a great company also, by the way. Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
So you get these 4 offers. The one at GM really sounds the most exciting.
Well, all of them were very exciting. And it was very difficult to decide, you know, how can you turn down the DuPont experimental stations at very elite engineering group that was one of the premier jobs in my field on Earth, if you wish. So how can you turn that down? So it was very difficult to make the decision. But finally, you know, in the spirit of doing something amazing, you know, I joined GM, and it turned out to be, you know, far beyond anything I could imagine even, you know.
Yeah. So what was the transition to Michigan like? I mean, you mentioned you needed your winter coat.
Yeah. On the human side, you know, we had a 2-seater British sports car, Triumph TR6. So we drove it across the land, you know. Took about, I don't know, 10 days or so, you know, and arrived at around 11 p.m. in, I think it was some sort of, maybe the first day of July or so, 1972, 11 p.m. and change, coming from the west. There was a big sign, "Welcome to Detroit, 95 degrees, at 11 p.m. It was very interesting. So we, you know, checked in a motel and, you know, went to the company the next day, etc. They were very friendly. The GM Tech Center is glorious. You know, it was built by Eero Saarinen, same guy who designed the Dulles Airport, Washington Dulles Airport's building. Glorious style. So I was very impressed also by the people, etc. Regarding housing, you know, the moving company guy, driver who took our furniture, few pieces we had, say that, you know, remember what I'm telling you, in 2 months you will start making arrangements to move back here. So I told Eva, you know, we better have it nice. So we found a glorious high-rise building in St. Clair Shores on the border of Cross Point, overlooking the Ford Estate. This was a gated community and very expensive, and you know, it was, the building was designed by Ian Pei, same person who designed the East Wing of the National Gallery and the pyramid in the Louvre.
Yeah.
You know? So it was a very high class building, and we hold up there. I said we have to have it nice for a while, you know, to make sure that we don't have any thoughts of going anywhere. You know? So that was transition turned out to be very nice, you know. Soon you discovered that you have a very interesting and somewhat amazing job. Eventually we had 5,000 people on this project.
Wow.
And eventually, you know, I was in charge of Catalyst Research, so it was just a very great experience. Yeah.
Now, how, when you first got there, what was it like in terms of kind of, so when you said when you first got to Daimler, you oversaw, you know, how many people it was?
Nine
technicians. You know, how, what was it like when you got to GM? Were you overseeing?
Well, I started, you know, started as a bench researcher, so, you know, I had, I think, one or two technicians. And then I became a group leader, and called it the supervisory research engineer. And I think it may have peaked by the time, in terms of direct reports, maybe in the 20s. But this was kind of forward research. We were the visible tip of the iceberg. So we published our work, we participated in conferences, filed a whole bunch of patents, etc. So, but we had basically, looking back, almost unlimited support.
Wow.
Essentially unlimited. The reason is that, you know, by September 1, 1974, all these companies had to meet emission standards mandated by the Clean Air Act. And they were such enormous economic entities that they could not risk not being able to sell cars, or being delayed in selling cars, or perhaps being fined for not meeting standards. So they deployed, you know, exotic resources. The paper I gave you, which where Jim Cumberton and I tried to summarize the effort, you know, shows that what effort was deployed there. It was one of the largest privately funded civilian research efforts at that time, possibly the largest.
So I was very curious about the nature of publishing and patents for your position, and you said that you guys were kind of the visible edge, the leading edge, and so you were encouraged to be publishing and encouraged to be publicly.
Yes, the company, you know, that had probably at least two reasons. One is, you know, by participating in the scientific community, you know, you gain an awareness of what is going on. You know, you cannot isolate yourself from the technical effort. The other one is, you know, that obviously the company wanted to make sure it is well understood that they do everything humanly possible to meet those standards. So genuinely, the effort was kind of pretty extraordinary.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the paper, you know, which I don't have in front of me, lists numbers, how many cars were built and how many catalyst combinations were run out of 100,000 miles and how many people were involved and how much money was spent. It's pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we need to correct this number once I have looked into it again, but somewhere on the order of about $400 million were spent on that project just in the years 1974, I believe.
Oh.
So you multiply that by, I don't know, at least five, probably more. So we are talking about potentially billions of dollars in 1 year. So anyway, it was a very large and very exciting project. You know, it ranged from scientific work, you know, catalysis, reaction engineering. We used a lot of math modeling. We had even a mathematics department, you know, which helped us solving our differential equations.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of computer work. We had ceramists, metallurgists. We had, of course, tremendous mechanical engineering capabilities in the company. Reams and reams and reams and reams, as far as your eye can see, engine dynamometers, running engines, testing catalysts. GM had a very good eye for hiring the best people from the top schools. And they went to Berkeley, Stanford, MIT, Caltech, Princeton, etc., Wisconsin, and hired very good people. So the quality of your staff was absolutely first class. It was very interesting. We had, you know, consultants, some of the top academics who worked with us. And we worked late into the night. We worked Saturday, Sunday. I had a very patient wife, you know. We were very excited, and also we worked against the deadline.
Yeah.
And it's pretty obvious that the body of work, which eventually, you know, qualified me to be elected into the NAE, was done at GM.
Yeah.
I had great colleagues and co-authors, and it was just one of those rare opportunities in life, you know.
Before we started talking with the recorder on, we were talking a little bit about history of science and in scientific papers, whether it makes sense to cite what has influenced the author or what has influenced the field. And I'm curious, when you started at GM and when you started doing all of this research, how large was the body of historical scientific research on this topic? Was this something that was really new that had to be kind of started from scratch, or was there anything to work from?
Well, catalysis, of course, has been around for a long time. Two things perhaps were brand new. One of them is basically nobody has ever operated a catalyst under these conditions of extreme temperatures for a very long time. Under transient conditions, you know, chemical reactors normally operate at steady state. You know. This thing had to cover a temperature range of room temperature to 650 C, and the gas velocity is ranging from idle to ridiculous. And the other aspect was, you know, nobody has ever designed reactors to operate at, you know, extremely high conversions for, you know, in this case, 100,000 miles. So, you know, the technology simply had to be developed. It didn't really exist by far. This is this explains the extraordinary effort. One interesting thought I heard at GM is that they talked with the established catalytic community, and basically most of the many of the experienced people, consultants, etc., said that this cannot be done. So there was a thought at GM, and they seem to have executed upon that. Let's go to hire some very smart, brand new guys who don't know that this can't be done. So there was an element of this, you know, and we really didn't know that this cannot be done, right? And you put your mind to it. And it was somewhat, you know, looking back, very similar to some Silicon Valley type of thinking. To do something amazing and essentially seemingly impossible. Mm-hmm. But when you conclude it is possible, you know, you go after it and get it done. So there was that type of spirit at that time, you know, in the company. Yeah.
Was there... within GM and within the community that's working on this project, was there any competition between different groups at GM to promote certain catalysts or to think that their way was better?
There was a kind of a friendly competition. Okay. It was not uncoordinated, but there were several very strong groups. Of course, in the AC division at that time, Flint, where all the practical work was done, you know, they have done a lot of good thinking, especially, for example, in metallurgy and ceramics, but also in testing. How do you test? You have to test these catalysts somewhat in an accelerated way. You mm-hmm. know, you don't have a year or two to test each and every sample. So they were good at that. GM had a very good advanced product engineering, they called it, vehicle people, who of course had to figure out the control systems. See, this is not only catalysts and catalytic reactors, but electronics and electronic controls and sensor work. So there's much more to this than just the catalyst and the converter. And the paper I gave you describes that properly, what everything else is involved. So the control system was worked out by the engineering groups. Then you know, you had to develop a sensor, an inferential sensor for feedback control. And a lot of good work was done in the metallurgy department on that, and also in the physics department, and in the electronics engineering department at the GM Research. Mm-hmm. So many, you know, ancillary disciplines were involved in developing this technology. But the catalytic converter itself, as it is composed of the catalyst and the reactor, mm-hmm. that was done by us.
Who are some of the people that you worked with to build the and create and develop that system?
The entire system, or just the catalyst and the reactor?
The catalyst and the reactor.
Yeah, you see, I published with almost everyone in the group and in the department. So from my list of publications, you can see who they were. you know, here standing on, in kind of in flight, I'm afraid to list names.
Okay.
You would want to list them and make sure you don't forget somebody, and also to list them in some order. But you can see those names, and we can add it to the document.
Sure.
I publish a lot of paper with a colleague called Seo, a Korean guy, brilliant person, and Jim Cavendish, mathematician, Jerry Summers, preparative organometallic chemist. Others who did very significant work, and a good part before I even arrived at GM was Dick Klimisch,
mm-hmm.
and Cathy Taylor, and both stayed with General Motors much longer than I did. So there was a large group of people there, and Ken Barron, I remember. So we can properly organize that piece of information and put it into the report if you like.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was curious, one of the projects that I've been involved in here at CHF is a project related to women in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really interested in Kathleen Taylor's name and contributions
yes.
to the project. She comes up frequently if you look online.
Oh, sure.
And I was just wondering how, if you had any sense of how many women there were kind of working on research in catalytic converter at GM.
Well, Elaine Sloan, she was a technician, but she was a chemist, and I co-authored the paper with her. It was mostly Kelly. There were others in other departments. In our department, we didn't have another woman. Basically, you know, the environment was not entirely dissimilar from today. You just hired the best people you could find. And I cannot remember any consideration as to whether you are a boy or a girl. It just had to hire the best people available.
Okay.
Yeah. So at that time, perhaps may not have been so many women in the profession either.
Yeah.
Much later, at you know, in the French company, mm-hmm. once we got there, we had many more women because they simply appear to have been more around and available.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in addition to the publishing, you were an active part of the scientific community, going to conferences and,
yes,
and
yeah.
talking about your work. Was there any discussion with the other big car companies, with Ford and with Chrysler?
A very good question. At that time,
international companies.
There was this antitrust or law or whatever it was. It prohibited us from any discussion of our work with other companies. So, of course, you presented papers, but we just followed the law and did not have any conversations with these guys. We, you know, met them at meetings, but we refrained from refrained from technical discussions. we were very proper, and you know, we were told not to bring the company into trouble by violating that law, and we didn't violate
right.
the law.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew who they are because they published, and you know, there was somewhat of a little bit, in hindsight, a kind of a mutual admiration, you know. For example, Ford people were outstanding, you know, and I always looked at their work and said, wow, what smart guys. And much later on, decades later, you know, we were still good friends and reminisce about amazing times, you know. Mordecai Sharaf is still alive. He is, of course, retired, and Hiram Gandhi has died in the meantime. But there was, the short answer is no, there was no discussion. And as a result, very interesting, the very first technology which was commercialized was very different between GM and Ford. GM looked at the monoliths, you know, which is a cordierite structure, magnesium, aluminum, silicate, which has a certain melting point much lower than the melting point of aluminum oxide. You could not make aluminum monoliths for some reason or other at that time. And the cordierite monoliths had the melting, at their melting point below the adiabatic temperature, the max adiabatic temperature rise of the reaction mixture which you fed into the converter. So unless you have very good, very tight controls, you would melt it. So needless to say, we melted a whole bunch of monoliths. So the conclusion was, you know, that we will use pellets at that time because they're much more robust. So the GM converter was a pellet type converter. You see a drawing of it in the paper, I think. And the entire exhaust stream was passed through these pelleted converters. Ford used at that time, as I remember, a monolith on one side of the engine and nothing on the other side, and you know, you can tune your engine for to run lean enough to have low enough emissions. There was a trade-off, you know, this was a very complicated subject because you also have to have the car drivable. It has to has a performance, has to have fuel economy, and has to have emission. So all these four, you know, it's a four-dimensional space, and GM ended up at a different spot in this four-dimensional space than Ford, because we have not talked with each other.
Right. Were there considerations that you guys had to take into account regarding things like weight, or I would assume you couldn't be adding too much weight to a car because that would affect its
performance. Well, that time cars were enormous, you know, they were somewhat the size of a, you know, kitchen in your house or something. Remember that, you know, huge cars. So, yeah, but yes, weight is always an issue in automobiles. And, you know, we had to size it properly. I keep on referring that paper. There is a picture there of one of the kind of early experimental GM converters from the 50s, which is basically taking up the entire underbody of the vehicle. You know, no, we were very careful in sizing it properly. You know, the larger the converter, the higher conversion it gives and the longer it lives. The smaller it is, you know, the shorter its life is, and the conversion is lower, but it is lighter and cheaper. So you can see that this is what is called an optimization problem. So after considering all these various variables, you end up with the size, which was reasonable.
Because of the antitrust issues, and you couldn't talk to Ford, you couldn't talk to Chrysler, how did the international car companies deal with these regulations? They were obviously also interested in selling cars in the United States. Did you talk to any of the international
companies? No, we did not. Not that I remember. Of course, we talked with the catalyst companies. There was some kind of, you know, cross-pollination, I guess, through the fact that we did not make catalysts. Ford didn't make catalysts. Chrysler didn't make catalysts. Volkswagen didn't make catalysts. Volvo at that time didn't make. The catalysts were made by catalyst companies, which sampled all the various different companies, of course. So maybe the Catalyst company could see what Ford is doing and what GM is doing and what Volkswagen is doing and what the Japanese are doing. So there was this, you know, orthogonal direction to across the car companies and other Catalyst companies.
So who are these Catalyst companies? Where do you acquire the Catalysts from?
Well, the company, the paper shows you that there were something like 95 companies who originally, you know, submitted samples. Mm. And of course, it was shaken down eventually to UOP, W.R. Grace, Engelhard, as far and Degussa, and Johnson Matthey. I hope I didn't leave out anyone. In terms of the impregnated noble metal impregnated catalyst, and then Corning made monoliths, and NGK in Japan made monoliths. And again, I hope I didn't in flight here forget somebody. The noble metal aspect is very interesting. You know, there was huge effort to try to avoid them, using them. When I interviewed with GM, it was in April 72. They felt that they, at all costs, they want to use base metals. When I ended up on site in the first days of July 72, they were all into noble metals. So how much noble metal to use? Well, the story is, I believe it's also in our paper, GM called up Impala Mines LTD, South Africans, and they had a reef called the Marensky Reef, which was slanted going down. It was, we should make sure we can correct these numbers.
Of course.
I remember something like a mile deep at that time, and I remember something like temperature down there was 61 degrees C. So it was a seam, foot or two wide granite, and you had to mine something like 12 tons of granite for each troy ounce of noble metal, which was platinum to palladium in the ratio of, I believe, 5-2 or 5-3, we should look it up. And so the issue was, and you had to blow, of course, cold air down there so people can survive. I think GM had to hire something like 15,000, or the company had to hire 15,000 people to mine that reef, build a town of something like 45,000. People, and it could be mined at a certain pace, and that divided by through the number of cars GM made worked out to be 0.05 troy ounces of a mixture of platinum and palladium of the ratio of the Marensky reef. So that's how we ended up with it. And so GM made a long-term contract. As I heard that time over the telephone, because of the hurry, you know.
The years passed and the research kind of ramped up and got closer and closer to kind of the deadline, did you find any further difficulties obtaining these noble metals? Or
no, not to my memory, but of course. Platinum prices started out low,
right?
Because there was not so much use for platinum at that time, and now I think platinum is more expensive than gold. And so, the car companies tried throughout this time period to reduce all metal loads. And that was done in a very brilliant way by making sure that you don't sinter the metals, that you anchor them to the support in rather sophisticated ways. So that allowed a very significant reduction of... I don't know where it is now, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is one-tenth of what we used, what we ended up using that time.
Maybe it would be nice to just have, for a general audience who might listen to this, your description of how the catalytic converter worked. I don't know. I suppose you might want to start with the two-way.
I
started out as an oxidation catalyst, of course. And one of the spectacularly interesting problems was that, of course, lubricating oils had phosphorus in them. And so the engine consumes some lubricant, there's an oil consumption. And so you expose the catalyst to some phosphoric acid and in the vapor phase. And also, as the lead was removed from the gasoline, the entire distribution system was full of lead. So there was a period, in which the lead level kept on coming down, but it was still there, traces of lead. And the most peculiar thing is that these traces of, basically these are lead halogen compounds in the gas phase, reacted with the phosphoric acid on the catalyst at the end, forming lead orthophosphate. And lead orthophosphate, you started out with a certain ratio of lead to phosphorus, and as the lead started to get depleted, it migrated, that ratio migrated into in the phase diagram to a point where you formed glasses. So suddenly, you glazed up the very outer micron or two of the catalyst. You plugged it up with lead orthophosphate. So some of the papers we wrote, identified this problem and, tried to design catalysts for structures to not to get plugged by lead orthophosphate. And then, eventually the lead was, over the years, swept out of the system. And people also figured out how to A, reduce oil consumption, B, reduce or eliminate phosphorus. So that is not such a major problem today, probably not a problem, I would assume. And that also contributed to the company's ability to reduce noble metal levels. So originally, for durability purposes, we needed more noble metal as well. Then as the emission standards kept on getting tight, and eventually we had to go to the three-way catalyst that operates at close to the stoichiometric point and has the sensor electronic feedback. So it is now a computer-controlled reactor. It's extremely complicated for several reasons. On the long run, we have this transient of activity changing over time. The shorter run, you drive the car, you step on the gas, you take your foot off, so the catalyst operates in that transient. And even on a very short scale, the air-fuel ratio was dithering at roughly at the frequency of 1 hertz. So you are feeding the reactor with the 1 hertz frequency of oscillating the air-fuel ratio between two levels. And then all these transients on top. So this, you know, mathematically speaking, this was an extremely interesting and very complicated engineering problem. How do you optimize such a... nobody has ever operated any chemical reactor anywhere near this level of complexity. Also, it's very interesting, you know, from a reactor design perspective, you know, it is an entirely different thing to design 1 chemical reactor operating at some well-defined set of steady-state conditions, but to operate, to design reactors which are made in quantities of millions, operated in this extremely complicated way. You know, this was, you know, your earlier question was what was new. This was entirely, nobody has ever even imagined anything like that. So we really brought a lot of new territory in reaction engineering, for example. Yeah. The whole field, in my opinion, was significantly affected by the catalytic converter.
How aware do you think the public was of this massive research effort that was being undertaken? I mean, the public was aware that cars were going to have to follow these emission standards, but do you think they had any sense that this...
I don't know. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to answer this precisely. I remember I had many invitations to give seminars at universities, and occasionally we got interviewed by newspapers. I remember I gave a seminar at Notre Dame, you know, and the South Bend Tribune came to interview me. And I was just a bench level researcher at the time. I said, well, you know, I'm afraid to, you know, we have to ask the company for permission to. He says, very clever, he was a very clever reporter. He says, well, you know, you can say your own opinion, cannot you? So I said, sure, again. So I explained to him how the thing works, and, basically I reviewed my seminar, which was public anyway, so yeah. I didn't really say anything different from what I was authorized to say in the seminar. Well, you know, 2 months later, see, there was no internet yet, and, you know, apparently General Motors read the newspaper slowly but meticulously. 2 months later, finally, it popped up there, you know, the South Bend Tribune interviewing General Motors scientist. So the title, big black title in the South Bend Tribune, "Catalytic converters stink but are not deadly," claims General Motors scientist.
Wow.
So somebody called me, "What have you done, Lutz?" I said, "Well, you know, all I did is gave a seminar." So yeah, the public was probably aware, you know, there was huge public discussion about, you know, obviously the smoke situation was very bad,
mm-hmm.
In some places, in most big cities.
Yeah.
Everyone agreed with that. The lead, you know, nobody wanted to have lead around. The counter forces were, you know, obviously a significant expense added to a car. And at that time, a huge drop in fuel economy and drivability. You know, cars didn't perform as well, and their fuel economy was very poor. So then much of the engineering effort was, you know, how to meet emission standards by making the cars drivable, reducing costs, and, you know, regain some performance. And look what's happening now. You have cars with several hundred horsepower, amazing fuel economy. I sat on a commission of the National Academy, NRC, over the past, we finished our work in March, so the previous 2.5 years. The task was to write a report about vehicles and fuels for the year 2050. So it was a large effort, 15, 20 people involved. And obviously we reviewed carefully what is the technology of today.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding how much, you know, some of us older persons who look back what we had at the time versus today, it really is truly far beyond what we could imagine. It's way beyond imagination. You know, the emissions are extremely low today. The performance is fantastic, unimaginable. And it's just tremendous what the synthesis of catalytic reactor technology and electronics has achieved. And this paper, you know, which I gave you, implies a synergy between catalysts and computers. And it was not our original title. I don't remember what, we had some mundane title. And it was Ben Luberoff, the editor of Chemtech, who somehow was somewhat of a visionary. They kind of envisioned that this synergy will lead us into a domain which goes far beyond what we can imagine today. I said, Ben, don't change your title. Louis, I'm the editor. So finally, changed the title. I changed also some figures, captions in it, not necessarily to the better. But anyway, it was, I give credit to Ben for visualizing what this combination of catalysts and computers can do.
It's interesting when you say that, you know, based on this task force that you've been doing all this research and work to understand what the current state of the technology is and how amazing it is, how low the emissions are, and how performance is so good. On the other hand, you know, you read these articles about people who don't necessarily have the same engineering or scientific background, but are concerned about the environmental aspect related to automobile emissions and gasoline use and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the question always is, well, why can't it just be better? Shouldn't cars be getting, you know, better miles per gallon and performing better? Shouldn't there be even lower emissions? And of course, many of the people asking these questions, like I said, don't have an engineering background, don't have a scientific mm-hmm. background. How do you explain to someone that we have made great strides? If we're going to drive cars, we have made really amazing strides.
Yes, we have, but you know, it does not justify stopping progress. I think there is an unbroken slope here. When you look at the future, if you look into the report which our committee produced, you will see further astounding progress. So we haven't stopped here. It is not so that we should tell the public we are done, we have done great work, everything is fine, and we stop progress. I think this will go on and on and on. The problem is much less significant now, the environmental problem, but you know, it's an infinite task. There are certain things which you know, don't stop. And you just want to balance, you know, this has three dimensions. Gave you a book we recently wrote about the U.S. energy future, and you can see that the problem is three-dimensional. It is technology, economics, and the societal domain. And the societal domain really is the so-called sufficient condition in Boolean logic. The necessary conditions are technology and economics. If something doesn't work thermodynamically, forget about societal concerns. You cannot beat the laws of thermodynamics. The second one is the economy, another necessary condition. If you cannot pay for it, it doesn't exist. To be realistic, you have to make sure that you can pay for something. But the societal condition, is the so-called sufficient condition, which that means it ultimately determines what will happen. And so all these three are moving forward. The society is, considerations keep on changing and advancing and become more sophisticated, more stringent, etc. The economy is always the economic conditions are always there. We just have to make sure that we can actually pay for what we want to do. And as I mentioned earlier, technology keeps on advancing. We have hybrids which recover a part of the inertial economy wasted. We have plug-in hybrids which, bring in some component of electric drive. And then, of course, look at the Tesla. Wow, amazing. You can drive 300 miles or 250 to 300 miles, depending on how you measure the cycles, on electricity at 3 cents per mile. And the car does not spread pollution around. The pollution control can be done at the power plant. Furthermore, the internal combustion engine operates on a thermodynamic cycle called Carnot cycle. So a very significant portion of the energy goes into your cooling system and is blown through the exhaust. The Carnot cycle has serious limitations at the temperatures at which materials used for engines can work. It could be vastly improved if you somehow could make ceramic engines, but how would you lubricate them? The power plant, modern power plants, the gas turbines, are not operated by the Carnot cycle, but by the Brayton cycle. It's a much higher efficiency. So you can see that you burn less fuel, control the emissions centrally, and they use electricity in vehicles, not spreading the pollution around. So you can see the future again. And that will be another humongous improvement, not only in the environment, not only in the use of hydrocarbons, but also in performance. I urge you to go and test drive a Tesla. They, in various modes, like Ingo-Prussia modes, they have a Tesla shop. Yes, it is an expensive car, but they're planning cheaper cars as well. The thing out accelerates anything. The electric motor has its rated torque, full rated torque at zero RPM. Its torque is not RPM sensitive. At any speed you drive that car and step on the gas pedal, it's like a rocket. It is just totally amazing, having no emissions either, having only 3 cents per mile energy consumed. The efficiency of an electric motor is in the 90s. The efficiency of an internal combustion engine is depending on what you include and exclude, but certainly not more than 20-some percent, right? So you can see enormous room left for progress. So don't imply that society should. You know, it's fantastic what will happen. Yeah. And this guy's also made a beautiful, beautiful car. It's just totally glorious, you know. So that's technology for you, you know. Very impressive. Yeah.
I guess stepping back again to talk a little bit more about some of the things at GM. You mentioned yesterday that the book that you wrote on catalytic poisoning was really the first book published on the subject.
Yes.
And I was curious if you could talk a little bit more about why you felt that book needed to be written. Why a book, say, as opposed to just paper publications? Why was that topic so...
Well, you know, there are books on various different subjects. You could ask the same question about any book.
I could.
And the answer would be the same. And if... you know, something has never been covered by a book that might justify a book, and if some field has progressed in some significant way, you know, it is helpful and useful to summarize it. And catalytic poisoning progressed enormously as a result of this monumental issue of how to make the catalytic converter survive the conditions at which it had to operate. So massive amounts of lead and phosphorus were passed through at that time, and the catalyst had to operate for 100,000 miles. So you had to figure out how to design catalysts for that. Involving geometries, like, you know, we published papers on the shape of the channels of the ordurite monolith or metal monoliths, you know, and published papers about the pore structure of the support, published papers about how do you manage the spatial distribution of the noble metals, where do you put the platinum, the palladium, the rhodium for three-way catalysis. You didn't even mention rhodium so far. All this, you know, happened in a very short time period, and a very large number of people worked on it.
Yes.
So I thought that I was kind of stunned that no book existed so far. So I was invited to a conference in Louvain-la-Neuve at that time to talk about catalyst poisoning. So at that occasion, you know, we wrote a paper. It turned out to be a longer paper than we expected. So publisher said, why don't we write a book? So we extended. Writing a book is a very difficult task, if you have ever attempted. My entire office was covered with paper. There was no internet at that time. There was really no computerized. The GM library had excellent, you know, search capabilities, and so they were very helpful. But it was still a monumental task, you know, to write that book. Oh my God. I took a big break after that before I got into the next one. You know? But that's why we wrote it. You know, it's a huge advance, it says, in a certain time period, and thought it's useful to document it.
Well, certainly if you have more to talk about the catalytic converter, we should do that, but it's about 10:20 and it seems like a good time to get some more coffee and take a break.
Okay.
But like I said, if you have more to talk about, certainly...
Well, it's endless. So I could talk about it, you know, for until dinner time.
Well, I guess since we won't be talking about the catalytic converter till dinner time, is there anything important about it and about your time at GM that we missed that we need to make sure that we have?
I just want to maybe summarize it to say that it was extremely lucky and fortunate, I feel, to have been involved with such a major development. The catalytic converter influenced life in the whole world now. It is one of the greatest technical successes of chemical work ever. It certainly should go into history. The ACS recently published, you know, at the occasion of, I think it was their 100th anniversary, you know, a timeline mm-hmm. of significant contributions of chemistry to humanity, and they failed to mention the catalytic converter completely. So the anniversary of the catalytic converter, 40th anniversary, will come on September 1, 2014, and the Chemical Heritage Foundation has an opportunity to step up and deal with it.
Well, I think we'll certainly be talking about what we can be doing at CHF, but let's take a minute to take a break, and then we'll get back into what happened next.
Okay.